clapping for me?
If you want me to. I clapped. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to or not.
I feel like we all need a round of applause right now.
I thought you were just applauding my clap. It was a
slow
good clap.
Clap.
Yeah. Slow all clap. Clap. Very slow clap. Just one clap. All right, well, we're on Criterion now, and I have an old friend and a new friend. So this is exciting, a new voice. So, of course, I'll start with the one we know. Hello, Mr. David Blakeslee.
Hey, Aaron. Good to be back. I think I drew a pretty good straw for this episode. There's a lot to talk about, a lot of cool stuff going on in the world of Criterion today.
You
so
sure did.
Glad to be with you again.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun one. This is a big one. And we have a new voice, Robert Taylor on the West Coast. Robert, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for...
Nice to meet you guys. It's an honor and a pleasure, and I can't wait to see which of us is going to be best friends and which one of you is going to be my nemesis. It's exciting.
You know, we're all friends here. We don't really have enemies. In fact, I was just talking to somebody else about podcasting, and they asked what kind of Criterion Cast drama we have, and I tried to think, yeah, we really don't have any.
No, that's there's true. no juicy behind the scenes friction. We get along quite splendidly.
We're almost deferential.
Aside from the Dress to Kill incident from last year, which still reverberates through these Hallowed Halls.
Yeah. Oh, that's just opinions, though. We just don't take that stuff personal. In fact, that kind of a nice little element of friction every once in a while, just to keep things a little bit unpredictable.
I think Keith would
not the total round the clock love fest all the time. You know,
I think he'd walk that back one though if he had to do it again. So, all right. Well, we have a new. This is our fifth show here. But if you don't mind, before we really get going, I'd like to shout out a good friend of ours has a new podcast, and you might have noticed that Brian Sauer.
On the screen, off the shelf.
That's right. I should know that by now. I've heard a gazillion episodes.
At least you know there is a shelf.
There is. Brian and Ryan's old show, which has been discontinued, and I miss very dearly. I don't think it's going to come back, but who knows? But anyway, Brian started a new podcast called Pure Cinema Podcast with a guy from Killer POV, and they changed their name, and I forgot the new name. But I think his name is Elric Kane. I could have that wrong. But they started a new podcast, and they put out one episode, and I've gotten through a lot of it. And that's just more of a get to know you. Hey, this is what we're doing. We're talking about film. So I'm curious where it goes. But if you missed Brian's voice, I'm looking forward to hearing his opinions again. And I'll put a link to their Facebook in the show notes. And should be a good podcast. And that's really it. So are you guys ready to jump right in?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think so. Although I will say, I definitely miss hearing Brian on Criterion Cast. And I'm not sure who their host is or if they're linked into any kind of a network or if the Criterion Cast beast will assimilate them somewhere down the road. But I do wish Brian and his partner all the success. I have not had a chance to listen to it yet. But, you know, Brian's pretty passionate. He crosses all genres, cinema high and low. So I think Pearson is a pretty good apt title for this latest venture that they're into. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say.
Well, his partner,
I can't wait to hear it myself.
His partner's into horror, and the Killer POV is a horror podcast. And so, and as we know, Brian is into cult film. I mean, he's into all film. He has great, wide-ranging taste. But I was curious what they would talk about, and a lot of it was the same art film stuff we talk about. So we'll see where it goes. But, yeah, I think it's a good first listen, and I'm sure there'll be plenty more. So, guys, May was a big month.
Huge.
Huge.
Stupendous.
Huge.
Spectacular.
Huge. Okay, wow. May was, tremendous. I think we've been maybe, I wouldn't say let down, but maybe the announcements have been a little lackluster. I've seen some complaints for April and March. I think one month there just wasn't a big tentpole release maybe to some people.
Well, a third of April was, you know, kind of breakouts of the two Jacques Demy films, and
there was that.
And so it's like, well, I already got that already, and you're right. There wasn't that kind of big, you know, standout, grab you by the throat. There's some cool stuff, definitely some intriguing things coming up in the next couple of months, but you know, May kind of blew it out of the water again. I think a lot of people were like, stand up, take notice. This is kind of a landmark month on the calendar.
Yeah, so
I picture it sort of like Russell Crowe in Gladiator. Are you entertained? Are you entertained?
I will be in May, and I need to carve out some free time in May because I have a vacation too because I have a lot to do. So we have 12 total films, but 13 actual films because we have two versions of Othello. So May is huge. So let's just dig in, and we have two upgrades, sort of. So let's start there. The first upgrade is actually, and Dave Eves predicted it, and he was right. And he was actually right about the pronunciation, too, and I was wrong, which is definitely not the first time. But Gene Dillman, Quai de Commerce, 23 Quai de Commerce, 1080 Brussels, is coming back to the collection finally on Blu-ray. That's Chantal Ackerman, who I know, David, you're a big fan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am. Yeah. We definitely talked about her on the Eclipse Viewer several months ago. Pauline Lampert joined us, me and Trevor, to kind of get into some of her, you know, early works. And one of the sort of a side issue, but it was a comment that I think was made on that episode and that's been made elsewhere, is that, you know, Criterion really seems to have maybe not given as much reverential attention in terms of the packaging and the Blu-ray upgrades. You know, Agnes Varda still has no Blu-ray releases on Criterion. And so here we finally do have, you know, Chantal Ackerman getting her due with a, you know it's a pretty amazing film, hypnotic, moves slow, and then kind of hits you like a ton of bricks as the cumulative impact builds up.
Yep.
I think it'll be really great to get Gene Dillman in the hands of a new set of people who will appreciate it, and it is as much a mark of recognition and just bringing this, you know, pretty pivotal piece of cinema back to everybody's attention again.
Yeah, well, it's a 2K restoration, so it should look nice. And this is one I saw in film school, although I don't think I saw the whole thing in film school. I think I'm probably missing. Because I saw it in a classroom and it's 3 hours long, so there's no way I actually literally saw it in a classroom. So I think I haven't seen the entire thing, but I've definitely seen a lot of it and the ending. I'm looking forward to maybe kind of revisiting and seeing it again for the first time. It is slow, and you could say that not a lot happens until it does.
Right, there's a repetition, there's a pattern, but that sameness, that cycle is part of the impact that the film makes on the viewer.
And the domesticity and the commenting on society and feminine society and gender roles, it's a very, very powerful. And so I think of it as an academic film just because I've spent so much time, really all the time, that I've talked about this film in a classroom. Robert, have you seen John Dillman?
Like you, I saw it when I was in film school at AFI, and it's the kind of movie where I was watching it and I hated it until I absolutely loved it at the end. I was watching it and it reminded me a bit of that movie, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, in that absolutely nothing is happening for hours and you just sort of want to kill yourself. But this had a delightful ending, and by delightful I mean horrifying, but it actually got my attention. And it makes you want to go back and watch the movie from the start. And when you're rewatching the movie, you're looking for subtle nuances throughout that you might not have picked up the first time, possibly because you were a little bored. But it definitely feels more engaging during the second rewatch than the first. And I kind of want to watch it again. Mm-hmm. It is 3 hours, so it's a lot of time to devote to it, but I haven't seen it in 4 or 5 years now, and I'm very curious to see if it holds up on a third viewing.
Kudos for the Lazarescu reference. I'm a big fan of that film, and I thought that was engaging from beginning to end. But that's another conversation. Would love to see that on Criterion. All right. Well, John Dillman comes out on May 9th. So yeah, we have a stacked month here. So May 16th, we have two releases. We have a new one and an upgrade. We have, we'll start with Orson Welles' Othello, The Moor of Venice. And Robert, I'll start with you. Are you a fan of this or Orson?
Well, I love Orson Welles. I think that this is the least of his Shakespeare films. That said, I've only seen the restored version that his daughter released in the mid-90s, which is not on this. This is the original 1952 version and the 1955 U.S. version. Now, the version that the daughter made was very controversial because she apparently had re-recorded the music and had shifted around the dialogue a little bit. So I'm curious to rewatch, especially the original version. It's not my favorite Wells. Othello's not my favorite Shakespeare to begin with, but it's still a wonderful film. Any Wells Shakespeare is something to applaud. So I'm very happy that it's joining the collection. I'm happy that it's the original two versions as opposed to ones that have been messed with and later in the film's history. The extras look great, and yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I will say the box art is very odd because it seems to match. It doesn't really seem like a Chimes at Midnight or Mr. Arcaden art. It seems more like art from the Hamlet Olive Signature box set, doesn't it?
It doesn't quite seem
like Criterion.
It kind of looks like a Bergman cover, actually.
Yeah, I was thinking Bergman as well, yeah.
Yeah. But go ahead, Dave.
It is nice to see what looks like a pretty definitive edition of this film. I have not seen it, so I really don't have much comment. But, you know, even The Immortal Story, which came out last year, and, you know, it's a film that's taken probably its deserved beatings, you know. And I can acknowledge all of that. But, you know, Criterion, what they did, the work they did in not just presenting the film in a pretty nice-looking restored version, but all the supplements around it really say, you know, if you want to have your shelf of definitive Orson Welles materials and what, you know, self-respecting cinephile doesn't, here is the Othello that you've all been waiting for. So I'm excited just to sort of see them continue amplifying their coverage of Welles, you know, mid to late career. Obviously the early stuff is a little bit harder for them to get a hold of.
Sure.
But it is a nice looking package, so I'm going to definitely enjoy it. I mean, Chimes at Midnight was, I think, my number two release of last year, and this may not rank quite high up in my year-end summary, as we're already looking ahead to the later months of this year, but I think this is an important release and one that I think is just one more jewel in the crown of this month's lineup.
Yeah, I think I must have seen the 1990 version, because I watched it on TCM. I recorded it from TCM probably, I don't know, somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago. I know that DVR existed when I watched it, so if that narrows it down some. But this one has the 1952 European version and the 1955 U.S. version. So I'm curious from if some Welles scholars, maybe Joshua Wilson is a big Welles fan, people might chime in and chime in. Ha-ha. People might let us know which is the definitive version, which one to go with first. My guess is the European, but who knows? But yeah, it does look like a stacked release. I actually will disagree with you a little bit, Robert. I think that Othello is a great story. I think it just has all the elements. It has the relationship, the triangle. It has conflict. It has deceit. And it has templates to make a really good film. And I'm trying to think of good adaptations of Othello, and I can't think of many aside from this one. And I might have to...
Oddly enough, there's one in the 90s when they had all those Shakespeare remakes that were set in high school. There was this little scene movie called Oh that had Martin Sheen in it that I liked quite a bit. But other than that, there's one with Kenneth Branagh that he didn't direct, but I think that one's not too good either.
Yeah, I think O was okay. It was okay. But but yeah, this doesn't hold a candle to this one. So, well, let's move on. I've been on an Ozu kick lately, and we're actually going to do a close-up episode on Ozu next week, which will probably come out in a couple weeks. So, I just watched Late Spring last night, which I'll save my thoughts, but I'll just say that Ozu, there's only a few left of those big ones left for me to see, and that's it's kind of a bummer. But as fate has it, these are two that I well, I've seen Good Morning, but it's been a while, and I haven't seen I Was Born But.
So dude, it's wonderful.
I can't wait. Yeah, it's silent, and those who know Ozu, he was a little behind the times as far as transitioning from silent to sound. And
he saw no need to change. He's already kind of in the zone there, and he just, you know, his pace of change was very, very gradual.
Very glacial, but, He never changed his camera lens.
He never went to widescreen. He was a late color adopter, and, you know, but once he started doing color, it was brilliant. His color compositions and his uses of color, of which Good Morning is one of the earlier ones, is, you know, it's pretty spectacular in its own way. Not spectacular in the way that you normally think about spectacular in the movies, but for Ozu, it really was a revelation to sort of see that kind of last chapter of his career take off there.
It's no Armageddon, but, you know, it'll do.
No, but this is such a welcome upgrade, you know. It's been kind of a running joke that, you know, the original DVD release of Good Morning is probably one of the very worst packages that Criterion's ever put together. I mean, if you have a chance, if you have that DVD, I'll just invite you once again just to pull that insert out of the case and just look at the horrible font that they used, and it's just it's ghastly, you know. And then the transfer, you know, is your typical early Criterion DVD, which is to say, you know, fuzzy and a little bit washed out. But what was weird is that it was the first Ozu to make it onto Criterion DVD, maybe because it was somewhat of a comedy. It is a little bit more of the entertaining side of Ozu. Mm-hmm. It was in color, and it's an accessible story. You know, it's about the kind of the emergence of, you know, the TV technology in Japan and a kind of a family's adaptation to these new ways. And, you know, of course, the cute bratty kids, which kind of, you know, induce their share of chuckles and all of that. But it's just so nice to finally have a worthy edition of the film on its way. I kind of had my doubts for a while as to whether they'd really get around to this or not, but well overdue. But they've really done it up with the supplement. You know, I Was Born But as well.
Yeah, well,
can we talk about that cover art? It's gorgeous. It's one of my favorite Criterion covers that I've seen in quite some time.
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting is there's always cover art hate, but this batch. And I went to Criterion Forum, just kind of braced myself. All right, which one are they going to take shots at? But no, this time all the cover art was universally applauded. And yeah, this is one of my favorites. I saw Good Morning. I have the DVD, so I saw it a long time ago, and I actually don't remember it that well. It might have been it wasn't the first Ozu I saw, but it was one of them. It'll be almost like a rewatch for me. And so this, we knew about the 4K restoration. I think it came out in Japan a year or two ago, and I think it actually was released in Japan a year or two ago. And so now we have the I Was Born button. This is another first, David. This is the first Splinter front Blu-ray upgrade of an Eclipse disc. So are you excited or disappointed?
No, I'm very excited. I think it's just going to be really nice, you know. Especially, I don't know if they've done any more cleanup work on it, because, you know, that are first Silent Ozu box. I mean, there are two Silent Ozu Eclipse boxes, but with the Eclipse series, you don't see a lot of evidence of digital cleanup restoration, and because they're for DVD, they're a budget line, at least as far as price per film is concerned, and they're pretty much presented, this is what we've got, folks, so, you know, enjoy it for what it is. A lot of these movies are artifacts, especially the early silent Japanese stuff, the Naruse set. Mm-hmm. Really, you look like, you know, you're almost afraid that the last, you know, reel of film is going to dissolve right in your hands as you're watching it on your DVD.
Yeah.
But if they have done some cleanup work there, that'll be very welcome. It's a beautiful film, very charming, very funny, very poignant. And for people who really just have come through Ozu, through Tokyo Story, the Noriko trilogy, and the later stuff, this will be a really nice discovery. And again, getting any early silent Japanese film on Blu-ray is a treat. You know, I kind of made a big deal out of a pre-war film with the Life of Last Chrysanthemum that came out last year. That was the only pre-war Japanese film that Criterion's released on Blu-ray to date, except for Now I Was Born, But, which will be coming out soon. And yeah, it is a quote supplement, but it really is. This is like a double bill.
It is a double disc. It's like His Girl Friday and The Front Page. This is a twofer, and I'm going to compare them. I think I'm going to pull out my clip set and throw it on my 4K TV and see if I can tell a difference. Yep. So Robert,
do it.
Robert, Ozu fan?
Of course. I really like Good Morning. It's one of his minor films, but it's still a very, very good film. I am so excited about I Was Born But. I have seen it once years and years ago. I think when the Eclipse set first came out, probably, and I adored it. I absolutely adored it. So I'm very curious to see what they've done to clean it up. As David said, and I just want to revisit it. I wonder if it's up on Filmstruck. I should take a gander and see.
It probably is on the service, but I wonder if this new print is on it. That is a good question. We're all agreed. More Ozu, although there's only so many left. But
yeah, there's also a segment of A Straightforward Boy, a surviving fragment there. So again, another pretty well-rounded package. Looks like there's pretty good essays that they've got in the works there. Just keep the Ozu coming. But you're right, it is a finite resource. There are some mid-career pieces, Green Tea Over Rice, Hen in the Wind, and a few others that are still streaming only.
Floating Weeds, actually. Actually, both of them. Both the silent and the sound. So
yeah, that would be another wonderful Blu-ray upgrade if they could get that double disc set.
Eventually. All right, well, the big whopper was the WCP, and I don't know about you, but I was very, very surprised about this happening, almost disbelieving. And I think this is actually – I like what I've seen of the first one. I haven't seen all of it. In fact, I'm going to make it a point to watch some more of it. But I'd say that as far as just the title caliber, I'd say this is almost like I'm trying to think of a sequel that's better than the original, but I'm coming up with blanks. But
Aliens, Godfather Part 2.
There you go. There you go. So these are some big titles, and I'm just going to run through them. All right, my pronunciation is going to be pretty atrocious, so just bear with me. All right, so we have Limite, I see that on these big, international lists of all-time best cinemas, so I'm really excited to see this. We have Revenge, Enciang, which is Lionel Bracha. That's a Filipino film. And then we have Mysterious Object at Noon. Apichapong, Where is the Thekal? Robert, you want to try that one?
Apichapong, Where is Thekal, I think.
I just can't.
Although, if I've offended anyone, I apologize, and I blame Aaron.
I was going to say, We Erase the Cool, but that's probably even worse.
If anybody's offended by that, Robert, they would have been offended like three shows ago when I talked about it, because I just could not get those syllables out of my mouth. We have Law of the Border, a Turkish-Syrian border film, which I think my wife's actually excited about, by Lufti Akad. And then,
did review that one on Criterion Reflections. It's an interesting, just these films are just coming at you from all different cultures. Pretty amazing collection. But yeah, then there's the piece de resistance at the end there. Go ahead, Aaron.
It's eclectic too. And this one included, we have Taipei Story. This is probably in fact, by Edward Yang. And I've only seen two Yangs, but I've longed to see others. I think it's more about availability rather than desire. I'd love to binge his entire filmography, but they're just not around in good formats. And in fact, I saw some people were complaining. If you can complain about this month, it's that Taipei Story, maybe to some people, the biggest title. You have to pay $100 or maybe $50 in a sale to see it, rather than your $27.99 on Amazon or $20 for the sale. But not a complaint for me. I buy this anyway. In fact, I think it's almost a good thing. Let people get exposed to these other what are probably great films and see the Yang while they're at it. So, Robert, have you seen any of these?
I have not yet, but I am very, very curious about Limite, especially because of the bonus feature that they have. Hang on 1 second. They have remastered the digital soundtrack from archival recordings of the same musical performances of the director and the arranger that were outside of the film itself. That seems like such a cool little weird thing to do for the film. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some people who have seen the movie, and they say it's Nutsy Cuckoo Bananas, and nice. I love Nutsy Cuckoo Bananas, so I'm very curious to see that one. And of course, I've never seen Taipei Story, so I can't wait to dive into that as well. You're totally correct in that it's so difficult to track down his stuff, but when you do, it's just like a nice little present. It's like mm-hmm. Christmas.
Yeah, that comes every 3 years, although lately it's been more frequently. David, have you seen any of these?
Well, yeah, just the one that I mentioned, Law of the Border, which is, you know, kind of interesting because it's taking place sort of at a pivotal moment in Turkish history as they're kind of really on the, you know, on the transition from becoming a more modernized, somewhat Western-friendly society. And of course, you know, Turkey's a nation. They're maybe not quite in the headlines to the same extent like Syria or some of the other, you know, hot conflict zones in the region, but Turkey's right there, mm-hmm. Right out there on that frontier. And I think just, again, getting in touch with the cinema and the culture of these other nations that really maybe don't cross our radar. I'm talking about Western viewers primarily,
sure.
You know, except for, you know, when they become part of some geopolitical crisis or something like that, but to really just understand these cultures as kind of, you know, impressive, awesome, you know, segments of humanity, and just understand what's going on there. It helps us, I think, understand today's world all the more. And I just really commend Criterion for putting this together, and as well as the World Cinema Foundation. I mean, what a, mm-hmm. you know, what an enormous amount of work I'm sure had to go into, you know, gathering these films, getting the rights, securing the best elements, and putting another one of these really impressive box sets together. It's also fascinating that this is a dual format release.
Yeah, so
let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah,
because it seems like they're saving this for, you know, particular situations where it just doesn't make sense to print up, you know, the two separate format editions, because this is kind of a comprehensive kind of library/collector's piece.
I think they're listening to their audience. Maybe Keith or people like Keith. Well, I know Keith's not an advocate for dual format, but just the symmetry and knowing how things look on the shelves. And I think that's probably exactly why they made this decision. And if there is a WCP3, and it might be a couple years because I think they probably need to get some films restored, but I have a feeling that one will be dual format. But I don't think this is a sea change that they're going to go back to the bricks that we loved, or at least no. I loved. Not everybody did. So are you a fan of dual format, Robert?
I could take it or leave it. I am a little annoyed by how they look on my shelf because they upset the Blu-ray/DVDs, but it's fine. It's all fine. I have the first one, and I'm very happy that it's going to look nice next to this second one because it is an essential buy for me. But I'm really neither here nor there, so I'm not going to lie and say that I have an opinion.
Okay, well, you didn't cave into peer pressure, but I think your Blu-rays will be they won't get upset about that. They'll be fine. They're highly evolved. So
this is the most tempted I've been to shelve my Criterions out of Spine Order in a long time.
They
just sort of do seem to belong next to each other. So I'll have to figure that out once I get them both in my hands.
You know? I have a feeling you're going to break that rule. I can't see them being at, like, you know, different parts of the shelf. It just won't fit. So, all right, the last one we have is, wait. Is that the one?
You skipped Ethan.
I skipped one. Sorry. in fact, I didn't give the dates. Othello and Good Morning are the 16th. Deep End comes out on the 23rd. And then World Cinema and Ghost World come out on the 30th. So Deep End. I've seen Deep End, but so before I get into it, have you guys?
I have not.
I'm super excited to watch it, though.
Okay, well, then I'll just say, I'll be brief because we've already talked about this a while. But Deepan is, it's Jacques Audiard, so it's his first in the collection, and I think he's a very noteworthy French director. I'm a big fan of a few of his films. And this one is, it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes a couple years back, Or was it last year? I can't. Time flies.
It's 2015, I believe.
So a couple years. It's actually very today, and it's even a couple years back. It seems like it's more relevant today. And it reminds me of like Len in France with it's an immigration discussion with some refugees heading toward France and trying to find their way, and there's a little bit of a clash with the locals. So I won't go too much into it. Fortunately, a lot of people haven't seen this, so there will be a lot of blind buys, and I think it's worthwhile. I think some people might actually not love it. I'm just going to say the ending might drive some people nuts. I'm not going to say why, because I'll just say it's a little bit out of characteristic with the rest of the film. That's all I'll say. But I can't wait to talk about this film with people. I'm sure we'll talk about it here and maybe elsewhere. So then, back to our final one, which we knew. This one had been teased by Thora Birch. Ghost World is coming on May 30th.
Woo!
Ghost World, Terry, I never figured out. Is it Zwigoff or Zwigoff?
I always say Zwigoff.
That's what I say, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's... That's the 2001 film with Scarlett Johansson as basically a kid then, and Thora Birch, who's also basically a kid. And it's based on the graphic novel by Daniel Clowes, I think that's how you say it, or is it Clowes? I don't know. And he also did a terrific cover. In fact, I'd say this is my favorite cover of the month. Maybe because they got the graphic novelist to do it. I just think that's a cool thing. But, yeah, I love this cover. I think it's almost perfect. I wouldn't say I love the film, but I like it a lot. However, I haven't seen it since, you know, probably shortly after it came out. So we'll start with Robert. Any strong opinions about Ghost World?
Like you, I saw it when it first came out, back when video stores still happened. And I really, really liked it. I love the cover, too. Not quite as much as Good Morning, but I still love it. My one letdown is I kind of wished that the comic itself was in the set. I would have happily paid an extra couple of bucks for it.
Yeah.
Because I think that this has a built-in audience who's going to buy it regardless.
Sure.
But it just would have been so cool if it were in there. It's a good movie. I'm looking forward to revisiting it. I remember Steve Buscemi is just fantastic.
He is great, yeah. Well, one thing that's, and I actually had kind of speculated / wished that the comic would be included, but it was a big wish. But at least I'm really excited about the commentary. It has Zwigoff, Clowes, and the producer, Leanne Halfon, on there. So I think that'll be interesting. I think it's really cool that the author / draw artist is involved in the production, and because often with Hollywood, the screenwriter, and you know this because you work in the industry, Robert, kind of get pushed out by the producers and directors. So, I think this is really exciting.
Yep, I agree.
By the way, are we allowed to say where you work?
Yes, you can say where I work. You just cannot say what show I am on.
Okay. He works for DreamWorks, and he's on Seinfeld. I'm kidding. He works for DreamWorks.
Oops.
Seinfeld's not even on, kids.
I'm on a show that's going to premiere on Netflix this year. It hasn't been announced yet, but as soon as it is, I promise to tell you guys all about it.
Very cool. David, Ghost World, what do you think?
Yeah, I have a Ghost World story to tell. Back in 2010, I was on a family vacation out to San Francisco, which is the Bay Area, where three of my kids were born. And we were just out there doing various things. And while I was out there, there happened to be an event at Amoeba Records out on up towards the Sunset District there in San Francisco, where Terry Zwigoff was there signing autographs for his then new released Criterion products of Crumb and Louie Bluey.
Nice.
And so I went and got autographed copies of those two discs and was chatting with Terry Zwigoff for just a moment. I was telling him about I'm a Criterion blogger, and I figured he'd be so impressed to hear that. But anyway, so we got to talking. He said, well, yeah, Ghost World is going to be coming out on Criterion sometime in the near future as well. So
yep.
It only took 7 years, but my inside source kind of paid off, and I can confirm that he knew what he was talking about back in 2010.
There were other rumors, but it was, I think Ryan had some.
Not
that early.
Ryan and Wes Anthony. I mean, we were all talking about this back when those were released. I was just beginning to get involved with Criterion Cast.
Yeah.
And I'm here sitting there, that's like 7 years ago. My goodness.
I'll have to article because I think it said imminent or coming soon or something. I think that's the way Ryan phrases these, coming soon.
Well, that's what Terry was saying. So, they had to work out a few details, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I'll be interested. You know, they talk about the audio commentary. Was that recorded in, like, 2010, 2011, or was it recorded late last year or somewhere in between?
Yeah, it doesn't say. I wonder that, too. I guess we'll find – well, we might not find out. It might just exist, and it might have been 2010.
Maybe they were just waiting for Scarlett Johansson to become the mega superstar that she now is so they could get the full traction out of this release or something.
Or maybe Daniel Clowe's been drawing this cover for 7 years. Maybe that's it.
Just slowly a line a year.
Yeah.
Looking for the right shade of green for Thora Birch's hair or something like
There's like 300 process prints of the cover. Well, that's May. Wow. Huge month. I can't believe we only took 30 minutes to talk about it. I fully expected it to be like an hour and a half.
Well, some of it, you know, we just haven't seen some of these films. Some of them are pretty well known. But I just marvel at the range. You've got the pop culture stuff of Ghost World. You've got the high art house of John Dielman, the classics with Wells and Ozu. A very new cutting edge director, Odiard, and then, of course, world cinema is just, kind of blows the categories wide open. So it's an amazing demonstration of what Criterion's capable of doing and bringing the best of film to its audience.
It's one of the rare months where even though it is 12 films, I'm going to buy every single release.
Mm-hmm.
So. Thank you for that, Criterion, emptying my bank account.
Well, in retrospect, it's kind of nice for me that April is such a light month. Save
our money.
A little bit
time
for May.
Then splurge in May. Although I'm sure a lot of people will wait for the Barnes & Noble sale in July to really fill up. I also just want to give a shout out, since I skipped Deepan, the cover. I loved the Deepan cover as well. And having seen the film, it really is appropriate. So. All right.
That wasn't Deepan visiting the Grand Budapest Hotel there? Or I kind of had that little bit of
I'm not going to spoil Deepan. Thanks for tempting me, Blakesley.
Oh, the Wes Anderson cameo at the end? I'll just forget I ever said that, right?
I accidentally spoiled Patterson once, so I won't do it. Well, speaking of sales, we have... Well, before I get to this, actually, let me correct a mistake here. I forgot to really... introduce Robert, except for mentioning his employer and the TV show he didn't want to tell you about. So, Robert, sorry about that. Will you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. My name is Robert, unshockingly. I am a screenwriter out in Los Angeles. I'm currently a writer on, as I said, a Netflix show that I can't tell you about.
Stranger Things.
But it's going to be great, I promise. As soon as I can announce it, I'm going to tell you all these exciting things about it. I can say it's a Western, at least that.
Oh, cool.
I love film, my top movies, I think. I love Chaplin's Modern Times, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Talk to Her, and Kurosawa's Ron. Favorite filmmaker is probably Kurosawa. I recently watched all of his movies at the same time. It was very overwhelming.
Yeah, that would be that. Well, they would move a little faster.
Yes, just a smidgen. So I recently rewatched all of those, and I am happy to be here. I love you guys. I've been listening to you forever, so I actually was having a bit of a starstruck moment earlier.
Oh wow! Well, we're just people, but thank you for loving us. That's our first time. The first time somebody's professed their love on an episode. So we'll take it. Translate that love into iTunes reviews for all the Criterion Cast. All right, well, let's get into the flash sale. And Robert, I don't know if you participate in these or if you're much of a collector.
Of course.
So we can get to that. But we're recording this on February the 19th. This is right about the time, more or less, where a flash sale could be happening. It's never guaranteed, but it seems to, or at least for the past few years, been pretty regular. One at the end of winter and one at the in midfall. So, friend on Facebook, W. David, or maybe he goes by David, he gave the dates of the past four, and they were last year was February 23rd, the year before was March 10th, and the year before that was February 25th, and before that was February 26th. So it could be this week, it could be the week after, maybe as much as 2-3 weeks, probably at latest if it's going to happen 2-3 weeks. And if I remember, I think last or the year before last, I think they timed it to coincide with a release, or at least that's what we suspected. So, flash sale. All right, Robert, are you going to spend much at the flash sale this year?
Well, I have just spent a lot at the Target sale, which we're going to get to very, very soon. I think that they might have it on Monday or Tuesday to coincide with Mildred Pierce and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, because those are both big releases for them, right? It seems like logically that would be the day. Plus, well, my birthday is Monday, so it would be a nice little birthday present for me.
That well, I'm sure that's reason enough. Come on, Criterion.
That's right. Of course, the Before trilogy comes out the following Tuesday, the 28th, which is still February, so it might be a little bit further back if you're looking at those dates being February, you know, 26th, 25th, 23rd. But, you know, hey, any Criterion flash sale is a welcome day for me. Being Criterion complete as I am, I don't have a whole lot. I think there are probably like three releases. I've already got a copy of Mildred Pierce as a review copy. I got the Tree of Wooden Clogs because Barnes & Noble sent me a $25 gift card because I use their credit card for a lot of my routine purchases. And then there's a 30% off coupon this weekend. So it ended up costing me like $1.50 after all the discounts and everything were applied.
All that. Wow.
So I need to get Black Girl and what's the other one that just recently came out?
We probably talked about it here, but
Camera Person. I need to get Black Girl, Camera Person, and then Women on the Verge. So I wouldn't actually mind waiting. I've already got my copy of the Before trilogy ordered from that infamous Amazon fumble there.
So I'm pretty well caught up.
But I also have a $100 Criterion gift certificate just sort of sitting there waiting for me to spend. So
see, now you're just showing off, Dave.
Well, yeah. I'm just giving a very objective, factual discussion of where I'm at.
Because everything David's said, pretty much ditto. Because I not $100, but I also did that buy one get one.
That's right.
Gift card, and I haven't used it, but I don't need a whole lot. I also have Before trilogy, which I can't wait for, coming from Amazon. I might find a couple old. I'm not as complete as you, David. Although you do complete me, but not Criterion wise. I'm sure I'll find, if I look, I'll find some DVDs to buy, but I don't need any Criterion box sets. I don't need any clip series. So yeah, I'm complaining about not needing anything. That's really a big problem for me.
But I do get vicarious pleasure from all the less than complete Criterion collectors who you know, get to celebrate. And that truly is, it's a blast to see how people, you know, divvy up their orders or what, you know, if they're just getting started, what are the titles that they pick up you know, when they've got hundreds to choose from, what's the 6 or 10 or 12 or whatever that they say, yeah, this is what I'm going to get. I'm always intrigued just to see how, you know, people are building their collections if they're not just filling in the gaps.
And speaking of which, we had a new player to the Criterion sale game, which actually caught me off guard, and I actually didn't jump in until I made a connection. So Target has a buy two, get one sale. And I was actually in Target the other day, not for this, but just because, and I noticed the signs. I'd already placed my order, and I just did it on pre-orders because I already have everything, and I didn't know you could use it on pre-orders. And by the way, it might not exist. I don't know when it expires, so it might, by the time this show goes live, it might be gone. But for now,
it's gone. It was the 18th.
Okay. Oh, well, never mind then. So, okay, it's done. Keep your eyes out. But it was actually not just Criterion's or not Criterion-specific, but it was puzzles, board games, books, and movies. So I didn't need any puzzles, board games. I guess I could have found some books if I had looked carefully, but I didn't. But that's a pretty amazing sale. I don't know if they're just trying to move units of everything, inventory out. But so, yeah, I bought two pre-orders and got one free. Both were about $25, $26. So that's I think that might – I haven't done the math, but that's probably better than flash sale. So, Robert, you partook?
I went nuts. I got Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. I got Mildred Pierce. I got Asphalt Jungle. I got Woman in the Dunes. I got The River. And what else? Pan's Labyrinth. So
nice.
I went a little cray, but well chosen, I think, and movies that I definitely love. So
you didn't go Trilogia then? You just went with the standalone Pans?
Well, I have the other two, and as wonderful as the box set looks, just I'd rather
I get
have.
It. I get it. I think I made that decision because it was so – we got it through a sale, and I think I had like a coupon or something. And so, yeah, I still have the other two and the box. Mm-hmm. So anyway, well, aside from the pre-order, did you get anything, David?
No. I like I say, I'm pretty well set, and I've got a Criterion gift card waiting for me, so I literally don't need to spend money on any of this stuff.
Right.
But it is fascinating to see a major retailer like Target. I mean, is Walmart next in line here for us to start doing our Criterion shopping? You know, Costco gets into the game every so often, about two or three times a year. It seems they stock up a little Criterion shelf there. Go ahead.
Costco's out. I think I've seen discussion they're not doing Criterions anymore. I haven't confirmed.
Well,
we don't have one.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, for me, Costco just kind of comes and goes. You know, like they'll not have any Criterions for a while, and then they show up again for a bit, and then they disappear again. So maybe something fell apart in that deal. I don't know. But, you know, but like I say, but to get Target in the mix, I mean, it's one thing for Barnes & Noble or even Best Buy, you know, they carry some Criterions as well. But this seems like new territory for Target, and it'll be just a new source of competition, even for the Amazons to wonder about, you know, biting into their share of the marketplace.
Yeah, you don't really think of them as a media company, but when these sales come out, you know, in the community, not just Criterion, but just in the film community, it gets spread around pretty quickly. But this, I'm always worried that the retailers will wise up to the exploits, and Barnes & Noble certainly has. I think this is just a corporate decision, so I don't know if it's something we can expect later, but it was pretty cool. So, all right, well, we're done with talking about buying stuff, which is the first
time.
Now watching stuff. So, okay, well, this week, the Tree of Wooden Clogs came out, and I'll say that Scott from Criterion Cast reviewed it, and also Trevor, your buddy, your partner in crime, reviewed it on his blog, The Mooks and the Gripes. And they both gave it really glowing reviews, and I saw some of it, but I'm going to let Robert start off. I'm curious what Robert has to say about the clogs.
Well, it's good. I am not unhappy that I saw it. It's one of those movies where it's basically a year in the life of a bunch of Italian peasants, and it goes out of its way to seem realistic and show that life almost to the point where the first hour of the movie, you don't get to know the families that much. It's more, oh, we're watching them kill a goose, we're watching them set up their dinner, stuff like that. So it's a little difficult to engage with the characters themselves. Once the characters come to the forefront, it gets better. Aaron, did you see the section of the movie with the mom who's a widow with the dementia-addled grandfather and six kids who thinks her only way out is to give the kids up to the orphanage?
No, I didn't get that far. I didn't give up because of the – it was slow-paced, that's for sure. And there are a lot of characters. It's difficult to keep up with that many characters, especially on a first viewing. You mentioned the goose, was it? There's also a pig scene. So if you're
oh yes, the pig.
If you have issues with animal violence, stay away. I thought it was beautiful, but difficult at the same time. Now a lot of times with slow cinema, when I kind of like we were talking about Gene Dielman, by the time that you get to the end, you kind of reevaluate everything you've seen. And I should add that Scott and Trevor both of them gave it a glowing review, and it did win the Palme d'Or in 78, I believe. So, and it's photographed beautifully. It just looks fantastic, and I think technically it's very well done as well. Yeah, I think you're right. It might not be as engaging, but I had to stop because I was prepping, so it had nothing to do with the movie itself and time.
I did watch it to the end, and it does not change my opinion of the rest of the movie. Fundamentally, I have an issue, and this is a slight spoiler. I mean, it's in the title that the tree makes a wooden clog, but at a certain point, there's a child who's going to school, and he breaks one of his clogs, and the father chops down one of the landowner's trees in order to make the son's new wooden clogs. And sure, I'm supposed to go along with it because the movie's poetic and blah, blah, blah. But in my mind, all I'm thinking is, dude, you have stacks of firewood. We can see the firewood right outside your door. Just use the firewood to make the clog. This isn't going to go well for you. And also, it's not as if there isn't a forest of trees around.
Right.
And again, I fundamentally know I'm supposed to go along with it because, you know, cinema. And mm-hmm. yet, I just was like, dude, you deserve what's coming to you.
Well, I did check. I have some critic friends.
It's hard to believe his motives are that innocent if he just had to chop down that one tree, you know.
Well, so this is a very divisive film. I know some critic friends that absolutely adore it and some that hate it. And I can see cases for both just based on the little less than half that I saw. So, David, any expectations going in? Or?
Well, I just picked it up yesterday, and it is actually on my screen right now, just a sort of pretty wallpaper there. I kind of wonder if this is kind of this year's Emigrants, the New Land, you know,
nope.
type of a thing.
No.
Let me finish my sentence. Without the appeal of Liv Ullmann and Max von Sydow to kind of, you know, galvanize our attention. Because I don't see the same kind of charisma or star power, nor do I see... I mean, and these are peasants who basically stay in their village the whole time, whereas mm-hmm. with the Emigrants in New Land, you have this, you know, literally globe-spanning progression and you know, many chapters of life as it unfolds, you know, across two continents and all of that. It does. It looks like one of those kind of, you know, classy, you know, not high concept. It's just one of those kind of cinema of quality things that were definitely right. kind of the Oscar bait and awards bait of the 70s and 80s. You know, you think about like when the Oscars were going to Out of Africa and that kind of thing. And this is sort of Ermanno Olmi's bid to get in on that game. And of course, it turned out to be very successful. Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty big fan of his early stuff, Il Posto and I Fidanzati, which are currently just two DVD-only titles. I went into those a few years ago when I was blogging my way through the collection, and I didn't have any real expectations, really had not heard much about Olmi or knew much of what these films were about, but they also focus on the ordinary lives of working class people, but the characters are very winsome and they're very charming stories. There's comedy, there's some poignant drama, and there's just kind of that slice of life, that kind of neo-realistic stuff. But at this point, it looks like Olmi's become much more of a big deal type of a director, mm-hmm. much more ambitious, got more resources. Of course, by now he's filming in color and a more of an epic scale, you know, homage of kind of mm-hmm. lost Italy and all of that. So, yeah, it's the kind of thing that has got certain prestige to it, and it probably is a high quality film. But yeah, it probably might be a little bit ponderous for a lot of folks and may not be watched more than one time.
Yeah, I don't think we're selling it here.
I think that hit the nail on the head. I'm very happy I saw it once.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say it's pastoral realism, neorealism. So, yeah, we'll see how that flies with people. And basically, when I read the description, I thought that doesn't sound very interesting, but I think it pretty much lives up to the description. It's pretty accurate. But anyway, let's move on. We have a couple, until the next episode of Criterion Now, we have three big releases coming out. So we'll do a brief preview. So we have Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, we already mentioned, along with Mildred Pierce coming out this week. And then the week after, we have the Before Trilogy. So a pretty big end of the month here of February. And David, I know that you're going to do a review of Mildred Pierce, and I've seen it as well. Any brief thoughts you want to share, or should we just wait for it?
I'll probably recap some of my whatever I say here in the review, which has yet to be written. I'll probably work on that tonight. But, you know, I am, I'll just start right off by saying I'm not one of these guys who's, you know, really grown up, you know, digging into the archives of Golden Age Hollywood. So, to me, Joan Crawford is just, well, yeah, she's a famous name. And I actually, probably my biggest vivid impressions of her as a young kid when, you know, I was, you know, born in the early 60s. And by the, you know, by the time I'm kind of coming of age and learning about, you know, movies and history, Joan Crawford is kind of like this scary old lady on TV. You know, she'd be on different, you know, talk shows or variety shows. And, you know, of course, she was always kind of
coat hangers.
Just one for the camera. Yeah, well, yeah, there's that. But even then, I mean, I just have
wire
never really...
hangers, Aaron.
All of that, yeah. But, I've never really gotten into that aspect of the story. So I've heard about Mommy Dearest. I've heard about all that stuff. But it's like it doesn't really mean a whole lot to me. I don't have a strong opinion on Joan Crawford. But this Mildred Pierce package, if you will, really heightened my interest to get to know more about her. The film itself is great. It's you know, Michael Curtiz has a little bit of that noirish thing. You know, I think this is one of the films he made a couple years after Casablanca, and you definitely see that kind of gripping cinematography and that style, kind of old Los Angeles, Santa Monica, where the film is set. So it's just there's a lot of cool character things, and then just, you know, kind of grappling with the persona of Joan Crawford as this woman who's really striving for her own independence. You know, this is a film that came out just a couple months after World War II ended. A lot of women were in the working world and fending for themselves. And I can see why this movie just struck such a resonant chord with its audience at the time. And the performances are incredible. I mean, Joan Crawford, Anne Blythe, Jack Carson, the other men in the cast. There's just a lot of really cool elements to the story and the film. So I can see, you know, why it's as beloved as it is. But then the surrounding features, there's a documentary, Joan Crawford, The Ultimate Movie Star. I think it comes from TCM from the early 2000s. And it really is a very nice career overview. So, yeah, to me, it just created a lot of curiosity and eagerness to dig deeper into her career and find out kind of what made her tick. And I know for a lot of, you know, Hollywood fans, a lot of film fans, maybe that's all old news, you know. But, you know, for me, and I'm sure for many others who maybe haven't, you know, they're more into the art house stuff, the Bergman, the Fellini, the Kurosawa, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a lot of substance here. So I was really impressed with the package and look forward to kind of sharing my thoughts a little bit more extended written version in the near future.
I look forward to reading it. I'll just say it's been a while since I've seen it, so I could back off this comment. But my memory is Joan Crawford is the least interesting part of Mildred Pierce. So we'll see if that holds up. We also have,
she holds her own. I think she commends herself very well.
You're credible. I'm probably wrong. So it's been a while. So we also have a Moldavar's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. I haven't seen it before trilogy. I've seen it and reenacted it kind of. So really exciting releases. So that did not become a supplement. I think we joked on it on some show about my iPod tour of France, but. But anyway, it's a great month. Robert, quickly, any comments on these three?
I love Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. I love Mildred Pierce. I love the trilogy. So I'm all on board. Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, I hope, is sort of opening the floodgates and we'll get a lot more Almodovar, because I, again, so love him as a director. And I so love the story that I actually went to go see it when it was a musical on Broadway. Spoiler, it sucked. But the movie itself is fantastic, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Cool. Well, I look forward to that one. That's one of the big holes in my Moldavar viewings. So, all right, well, I'm going to move along. I'm actually going to skip a couple. Well, I'll just mention a couple things briefly. There's rumors and maybe a hint based on Criterion Current that Rock and Roll High School might be coming, which is interesting. Also, there's a fandom page for a director named Renan Shore, and people suspect that maybe Late Summer Blues is coming. And Jonathan Terrell may have championed that. And also, there was a Jean-Luc Godard short that was discovered. So we're running along, so I'm just going to cover those.
Can I just say one thing about Rock and Roll High School?
Sure. Okay.
I mean, I'm an old school punk rocker.
Yes,
I
you
played
are.
In the Bay Area and all that scene back in the early 80s and all. I was a big Ramones fan, saw them live back in the 70s and all of that. But as much as I was excited at the time to see Rock and Roll High School, one of my favorite bands up on screen, I walk out of the screening back then kind of unimpressed. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'll never complain or to the point where I'm just like down on Criterion utterly. I don't really think that film deserves a Criterion package release. If they want to put it on Filmstruck, if they want to stream it, that's cool. Have a little fun with Roger Corman, but you know, that's mm-hmm. just not that good of a movie. The soundtrack is all right.
That's going to be
if they're going to include any Corman, they have to do the Pose stuff. I mean,
well, sure. There's much better Roger Corman, but that was just, I don't know, it was just kind of a misfire. And again, I say this from an old school Ramones fan perspective, so hopefully I've got some credibility. Think about this, Criterion. I hope you're listening.
I saw it when I was a kid, so I don't really have any authority here, but I know it will be controversial if it comes out. Was that Corman?
He was involved as a, like executive producer. I mean, he helped put the project together. I think
okay.
I think he recognized the Ramones were this thing that was a little bit offbeat, you know, a little bit of, you know, burgeoning. And of course, you know, the Ramones are kind of a legendary cultural institution now, but back then they really weren't. They were kind of an oddball phenomenon.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they just tried to make them too pop and cutesy or something. There was just, I don't know, it just did not come together the way I had wished it would, you know, when I was really hoping the Ramones to become a big time, you know, commercial thing. But anyways,
this was probably, and I'm a Ramones fan too, or at least of the early Ramones. This is kind of the transition between their punk stuff to the more bebop yes. stuff. So
they were trying to do the rock and roll radio, and then
right.
with Phil Spector, and it's just like, look, all yeah. we want is three chords and the truth.
Exactly.
Guys.
Just keep playing it faster. Keep playing it faster. All right, well, okay, this one's sensitive. So this next topic is there are a whole slew of films leaving Filmstruck, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes. Now, some of this we did expect because they even said a lot of our rights we've negotiated are just streaming rights, not permanent, so expect them to happen. So I expected that some we'd lose some, especially from the main channel, and that those were basically a regular rotation. But there are some being removed from the Criterion channel, too, quite a few. So it's a little disappointing. And there are some, actually, that are being removed that I would expect would stay. And I don't have examples with me. But
Beauty
yeah.
and the Beast, M, Le yeah. Samurai.
Yeah, there's a bunch. So, yeah, La Cage aux Folles, a whole bunch that are disappointing. Not that La Cage aux Folles is the best movie in the world, but that's just one example. So, but I really want to know your perspective on this, David, because you are the keeper of the Criterion chronology.
yeah, very frustrating. Well, just because it's really hard to know. I mean, I, you know, so for people who don't know, what I'm talking about is I've made this really long list on Filmstruck that basically mimics my blogging list so that you can go through the whole history of the Criterion-related films from the early days of the Chaplin Silence all the way up until, you know, Camera Person or whatever else is mm-hmm. the newest thing that's just come out on the Criterion label. And so every month I go in and I kind of try to drop in all the Criterion-related titles. And, of course, when Filmstruck come up with hundreds of new titles, you know, I was in this dilemma. Do I just do the Criterion-only stuff? Do I do the Filmstruck stuff? Some of the stuff that's on the Filmstruck channel is also Criterion-branded or is Criterion associated by disc release or it was stuff that was over on Hulu because I had all the Hulu lineup lined up, you know, in that list as well. So it just became quite a burden. And then I'm having some other issues with Filmstruck in that it's very, very slow to reload, so my chronology is not quite as complete as I would like it to be, but it literally takes me like 1 to 2 minutes to move a film because of just mm-hmm. I've got like over 2,000 films in that list now, and it just doesn't refresh or update very well. So anyways,
sorry, are you going to leave these on there or are you going to purge them?
I basically decided just to go with the Criterion channel exclusive stuff, mm-hmm. but my feeling is that it'd be almost like a disc going out of print. Just because it goes out of print, I don't take it off the list. So if it was
still belongs
associated at one time, then it's going to be on the list. So, but I just wonder, are they going to rotate these in and out, or are they like gone forever, never to return? Because it's a lot of stuff that's going to be lost. And, you know, unless you're a real fanatic that doesn't watch anything else, including your discs, there's just no way you would have been able to take all of this in. And again, we're talking about a service that's, what, maybe, what, 4 months old, five months old?
I started to have a nervous breakdown as soon as I saw the list. I was like, oh, God, the 60 things on my to-watch list, I'm going to lose about half of them.
Right.
And I've basically just been sitting in a room crying, eating popcorn, trying to catch up. And I don't think I'm going to before they disappear.
Yeah, you really, in order to stay complete on your list, not that really anybody is going to be all the way complete on the chronology, although some, I think Matt might be pretty close, but you really have to watch them as they come out or track them down somewhere afterward. Well, so one question to both of you. I'll start with you, Robert. So is this such a drastic change that changes your desire to subscribe? Because I have seen that comment from people.
Not yet. We'll see how much further it goes. I mean, it is like 350 films over the next 2 months are gone. And if it's replaced with something that is extraordinary, I will happily eat my words. But
yeah,
like,
if it's a true rotation where out with the old, in with the new, you know, and it's good quality in with the new, not like how Netflix is sort of kept their titles up, but the quality is kind of down the tubes there.
Except for this TV show that's coming out later this year that may or may not be a Western.
Yeah. It's not that I want to slam Netflix. I mean, that's a great quality service.
Well, so far, I like the curation aspect of Filmstruck. So, I think the rotating things, I'll just have to be on notice that if there's something I really want to watch, I better get right down to it because it might be gone in a few months. So.
Yeah, and they are giving us, like, you know, The Conformist is the last one on the list right now, which that will disappear on April 14th. So as long as there's some heads up, I guess fair's fair. But, boy, this seemed to come out of nowhere, this list. And, you know, by the time I'm seeing the list, it's already past some of the early dates of February
where
these things started disappearing. It's like, wait a minute. Man.
There was one that was already gone. I was like, hey. Well, okay, I know we have short takes to do, but let's just go ahead and move on to Filmstruck and then do the short takes afterward. And let's do speed round. Fun stuff. All right? Did you guys listen last episode? Do you know what I'm talking about here?
I do, yeah. You just sort of throw out the director, the name, the category, and we just have a reaction.
10 seconds, and I'm going to start by playing some music. Ooh. Robert, Wim Wenders, The Masters, 10-second response.
Super excited, can't wait to watch Wings of Desire again.
David.
Well, it was Wim Wenders, and when the graphic first came up, I don't know if you saw that. It was kind of a typo in the artwork. They spelled Wenders, Winders. It's been changed since then.
Went past your 10 seconds. You're in the penalty box. Not really. I love Wenders, but there wasn't really a whole lot of new stuff, so yeah, it's basically the stuff on disc. So I was hoping for the restoration thing. I think I'm almost over time. So, all right. David, Mann/Alton Noir, Anthony Mann and John Alton. Any thoughts?
I watched T-Men last night, one of these vintage gangster noir films from 1948. Great cinematography, horrible voiceover, kind of corny propagandistic framing, but a really wonderful film. I was intrigued.
Robert. Man, Alton Noir.
I've only seen Border Incident, which I really enjoyed. Looking forward to seeing the other four.
I have not seen any, but I love Anthony Mann's westerns. Just love them. So I hopefully this will stick around so I can watch a couple. All right, David, you're still in, but I'm going to go to Robert first. Circus Acts.
Sure. Why not? Probably not, actually.
David, Circus Acts.
I have no response. I'll just save my time for another category.
Okay, you're going to cede your time.
I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah, we always invent this as we go along, so there's no rules. But I don't think Les Enfants du Paradis was on here, even though it is and isn't Circus Act, it should be on there. All right, David, cinematography by Rudolph Mate.
That one flew past me. I don't have a reaction.
All right, Robert.
Ooh.
Aaron, pass. I did look at the list and it looked interesting, but not a whole lot of thoughts.
Any titles that jumped out?
I didn't write down the titles, but I'll look them up as we finish the speed round. Robert, Takeshi Kitano, any thoughts?
He did Zatoichi, the remake, right? I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Okay. David?
Just a new Japanese director that I could probably get in touch with, but I'm still into my Japanese classic cinema, so I'm good with that for now.
Well, he goes by Beat. I actually like Kitano, and I actually like that Zatoichi is one of the Kikujiro. That's what I'm going to say. That's a great film. And actually, that might be an old one because I looked for it on FilmStrike and it's gone now. I'm sorry, it is there now. Never mind. All right, that's the end of the main channel film speed round. And Robert, you won because...
Yes!
David went over his time twice, so that's the way you play the game, David.
I forfeit my consolation prizes as well, even. Boy. I'll try to do better on the Criterion channel.
All right, well, get your buzzers ready. All right, before we get to speed round, I want to talk about the short feature and the Friday night double feature. So I think we'll have some things to say about this because you're a young punk, David.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And we both are, I think, are big Buzzcocks fans. So the short plus feature was Love You More by Sam Taylor Johnson, who's actually, I think her name is Sam Taylor Wood, same director of 50 Shades of Grey. And if you've seen this short, you get it.
So, yeah, definitely.
Little love story, nice Valentine's tie-in about a pair of kids who bond over a Buzzcocks single. David,
they
thoughts?
They really do bond.
They did.
Yeah, I was pretty delighted to see that. Of course, you know, the Buzzcocks single, I was a Buzzcocks fan back in 77, 78. They were coming up alongside the Sex Pistols and the Clash and all those great English hardcore punk bands. But they were a little bit more pop-oriented and really, focused on making great hit singles. And, and this really just, it felt to me like a flashback, and this was set in Britain, and, so it's a little bit of a different set atmosphere than what I was living through in the States at that time, but, really just, kind of got a little friskier than I was expecting, so, yeah, don't, if you're going to be watching this on your commute to work on the subway,
in front of children, make sure you talk to the birds and the bees first.
Keep it inside your jacket or something there, yes, indeed it does, but, pretty amusing. The guy in this little pair looks a lot, uncannily like bass player in my old band. So
oh, cool.
That was another just a little sort of retro throwback surprise.
I've been singing that song all week. I'm in love again. Feel like this. All right. Robert, any thoughts on Love You More?
I will generously say it is not my taste.
Really? Okay, yeah. I expected that with some... I think you have to be into the punk scene to really get that, because I could identify with what they were bonding over. It was paired with Picnic at Hanging Rock, and aside from there being, like, teenagers, young kids, I didn't really see the connection. And David, I know you did... you're working on Picnic at Hanging Rock project.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Trevor and I did a... No. I would say that the behavior of the young woman in Love You More would not have fit in at Mrs. Appleyard School for Girls, maybe in 1900 Australia there. But
maybe
Trevor Barrett.
Secret ending.
This girl's definitely been expelled from Mrs. Appleyard's college there. Trevor and I recorded a main episode for Criterion Cast on Picnic at Hanging Rock on the Saturday before Thanksgiving. It was last weekend, but he ran into
Saturday
a little
before Thanksgiving.
Bit of a Saturday before Valentine's Day. Sorry, you can edit that if you wish.
No, I won't.
But anyways, we hope to have it in there for Valentine's Day because that's the day that the notorious events of that picnic are set in the year 1900. But Trevor's still putting the finishing touches on that one, so it'll be out soon. But yeah, other than the Valentine's Day, I guess the romance of February 14th,
that must
be the theme there.
Yeah, Valentine's Day. That's they have pretty loose connections. I've noticed they're. I don't want to say lazy, but curious, kind of fun.
Maybe just throw it against the wall, see what sticks, right?
Yeah, why not? It's a short feature. All right, Friday night double feature. Elevator to the Gallows, Louis Mal, and Black Sun by Kurahara.
So, yeah, that's a jazz connection there. The Miles Davis soundtrack for Elevator to the Gallows is pretty famous.
Oh, yeah.
And then Black Sun is Max Roach, the kind of...
Nice.
Yeah, the incredible little drummer. I mean, he just takes percussion to a whole other level. And Black Sun is a story of a young man, just kind of a Japanese hoodlum type of guy. He meets up with an American GI who's in kind of one of the military bases in Japan, who's kind of gone off the deep end, killed a guy. He's on the lam. He's got a gun, and it's just basically the interaction of this young Japanese man who idolizes Blacks, African people, and he's all into jazz because they're just like this superior breed of humanity, and the kid's all very impressionable. But when he actually meets a real Black American, he's amazed that this guy doesn't know how to play jazz and doesn't fit his cultural stereotypes. But it's a really kind of crazy manic film. We covered it in the Eclipse Viewer several months ago with Pablo Canota, our good friend, a Japanese genre fanatic. But yeah, that's the connection there, is the musical soundtracks for both of those films really explore some pretty classic vintage early 60s jazz.
All right, we're back to the speed round. Robert.
Yes.
Actually, first, Robert, do you have any speed round comments on that, on those two?
I like Elevator to the Gallows. I've never seen Black Sun.
Me too. All right. All right, speed round. Kirsten Johnson and Michael Moore on Unintended Consequences. Robert.
Can't wait to dive in.
Aaron, it's awesome, but I've seen it on the camera person disc. David.
It make me wonder why I have not yet gotten up to the Traverse City Film Festival, which is where that little documentary piece was filmed. So I'm going to try to get up there this summer. It's in July. Michael Moore lives up that way, and I just got to get there. So that's my resolution for July this year.
David cannot play this game. He cannot contain himself to 10 seconds.
I know.
All right, David, I'm going to hold you to this one.
Bound of information.
Ace in the Hole is expiring on the 28th. Do you care?
Goodbye.
Robert.
I'm going to miss it so much.
Aaron, it's
if only I had it on Blu-ray.
It's on my shelf, so but at least we know the spines are not definite. At least they gave us a heads up, so that's nice. All right, Lions in Winter, Robert.
They seem like fair movies. French Can-Can's great. The rest of them I could leave, basically.
David?
I wish they had John Huston's The Dead rather than Wise Blood.
About the same
thing. I agree.
And I'm going to say Saraband. How come they didn't have Saraband? Well, probably rights, but still. All right, and then the last one, another spine release, is Carlos. And I'm going to start with myself first. It is one of my wife's favorite films of all time. So, and I haven't seen the third part. David, Carlos.
The spine releases are not such a big deal to me.
Okay. And Robert. Do you care?
I tried to watch it twice and fell asleep. It could have just been because I was tired, though.
Boo. Okay. That speed round. I think that was a tie. Three-way tie. No, I shouldn't really judge myself. So, all right, short takes. And we are running a little long, so we'll have to be a little short. But David, I'm curious about this one. Let's hear your take on I'm not going to say it.
Symbiopsychotaxoplasm, take one. I just posted a review a couple days ago on Criterion Reflections, my blog that's hosted on Criterion Cast, and I just kind of jumbled a little word salad out there, which I think is keeping in spirit of the film. But
absolutely.
Yeah, I do have a lot of stuff to say about it. It's just such a fascinating, as I put it, a film about the filming of a film being filmed. and it just, it's probably the most meta film that I've ever seen. There's a central conflict of this screen test that's going on, these two characters kind of reenacting the same scene, which is basically a conflict between a closeted gay man and his wife, who's basically confronting him, and he's trying to gaslight her and convinced her that there's nothing going on. Pretty awful scene, especially since it's being played out in a public setting in Central Park in New York City with onlookers gathered all around, and the woman's crying because the man has forced her to have multiple abortions, and it's just like, how many, and of course they're throwing F-bombs at each other, and it's just a nasty public conflict, which in a twisted way is kind of hilarious just because of how audacious and grotesque the whole thing is. But what is really going on here, and how much of this is scripted, how much of this is planned out, how much of this is William Greaves, the director, just kind of stirring up some chaos and making a movie out of it, you know, kind of a psycho drama thought experiment that it's perfectly in keeping with the ethos of the late 60s. You wonder at what point do the hallucinogens or other stimulants play a factor in just getting people to even conceive of this type of project or participate with it in the first place. So, yeah, it's a movie that probably would be worthy of extended discussion. Won't take the time for that now, but yeah, even with a 1,200 or 1,300 of review that I wrote the other day, I feel like I'm still scratching the surface, and I haven't even seen Take 2.5 yet, which was done a couple decades later with Steve Buscemi and Steven Soderbergh's input, as well as Greaves and a couple of the actors brought back for the next stab at this weird project.
I haven't seen it either, not the second one, but yeah, the first one's fun. So, all right, Robert, what's your short take?
The Uninvited, the Lewis Allen horror movie from the 1940s, which I absolutely adored. It's so tonally interesting in that it can veer between high comedy and absolute creepy terror within the course of 2 to 3 minutes. I think a lot of it is the fantastic film score, but it's also impeccably written. And it has one of my favorite moments ever in horror films, which is when Ray Milland finds his sister sitting on the stairs at night, and they can both hear crying downstairs, and the sister just talks about how she's checked everywhere, she can't find where the tears are, and it's this beautiful meditation on sadness and ghosts, which I found beautiful. It's a bare-bones Criterion release, but that said, I highly recommend it to anyone who enjoys a good ghost story.
Great special features for the time, too. They're special effects, I should say. Well, mine is Annos Amour. I probably said that. Annos Amour, French film. It's actually my first film by Maurice Pilet, and I want to say a lot more from him. I actually really took to this. It's difficult, though, because it's about a teenager who is very promiscuous. However, I think they handle it well, although some people might say that they probably show the teenager a little too much. It's the actually a tremendous actress that we know from Vagabond, Cédrine Bonnaire, and a number of other things, La Ceremonie, and she's a big-time French actress. But she plays a girl that really needs to be loved, and there's it's very intense, a lot of drama at home, a lot of histrionics, you could say.
If you don't love her, she will make your life miserable.
That's true. So yeah, I did take to this film, and you see a promiscuous female, but you don't really, I hate to use this expression because I don't like this expression, but there's no quote slut shaming. You know, she is just love. You know, she just loves. She loves to be in love, is what it is. So I really enjoyed this. This is not on Blu-ray. I would like it to be. I think a lot of the PLA films are not even available to Criterion. I think La Fons New is, and the rest.
That's one of their very last DVD only releases before they started releasing everything in the either or format, which is also a really excellent film. But I get the sense that he's a much more significant filmmaker than even Criterion has been allowed to showcase, just because maybe they just haven't got the rights. Or I think he's also kind of a notoriously difficult, temperamental person. But yeah, I would really love to see more of his work. I think there's a whole vein of more contemporary French films that could be explored. So maybe they'll find the key to that and get it out.
Yeah, I get that from his film, actually, that he's probably pretty explosive and difficult. Does some rough things with his actors, but there are a number of his films on Cohen Media Group. So I think there's a triple feature, and I think there's another single disc release. So yeah, a lot out there. But and there's a lot on Region B as well. So, okay, well, we're going to move into the fun final two segments. We're almost done here, guys. Bear with me. So my favorite segment is to hear what you guys have been doing. And I'll start with David. I know you've already mentioned a couple things, but what have you been up to?
Well, okay, so I've mentioned the picnic at Hanging Rock, which will be up. I guess it's a race between Aaron and Trevor to see who can get their next episode edited first, right? But they'll be up pretty close to each other. And then we have Nikatsu Noir Part 2, which has been on a little bit of a hold. We did the first episode a few weeks ago, and we're working through some technical issues with our guest, Pablo, as he gets some computer things and software in order. But we'll be back to finish up that series and then moving on to next things in the Eclipse Viewer podcast. And then another one that I did was kind of an interesting one-off. I was on a film podcast called The Last Wave, which is down in Australia. It's hosted by an online friend of mine, Andrew Pierce, and his project is to bring greater awareness to Australian cinema. And at the end of the Picnic at Hanging Rock episode, I just mentioned to Trevor, I really don't know a whole lot about Australian cinema. I mean, I think about Mad Max and Crocodile Dundee or stuff of that sort. But, you know, there's more to it than that, obviously, but I feel like I'm still a neophyte. And so I was very fortunate to guest with Andrew at his invitation to watch a very early Australian silent film called The Sentimental Bloke, which was filmed in 1918, released in 1919. And I've had about a 30-minute guest spot on his kind of history of Australian cinema. So I'll try to put some tweets out with links to that episode when it goes on the air. But nice. That's pretty much what I've been up to.
That sounds interesting. Yeah, Wake and Fright. Boy, that I just saw it a few weeks ago, and it still traumatizes me. Robert, I don't know if you can say what you've been doing, because
I can't, but I can say that I recently finished watching all the Kurosawa movies chronologically. I've written essays about each film, and I'm currently building a website where I'm going to publish them all. So hopefully news on that very, very soon.
Well, when you get that up, we'll make sure you share the link, and we'll let people know about it. I'm not gonna read an essay about every Kurosawa film right away, but I'll definitely let that guide my viewing as I watch some for the first time and rewatch others.
Awesome.
All right. Yeah. Well, that's awesome, and thank you again for being here. What I've been doing, well, I've been doing this show, and I'm working on an Ozu show, and today I recorded another Rainer Werner Fassbinder episode on Wrong Reel, so that should be up in the next day or two. If it's up by the time I finish this one, it'll be in the show notes. If not, I'll put it on social media. I think James and I had a pretty good conversation going over, you know, this guy that put together 40-something films in 15 years, and we covered them in about an hour and a half, so that seems fitting. The final thing is our piece of flair. So, Robert, what's your piece of flair?
Well, in honor of Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown being released, I thought I'd bring up Almodovar's new movie, Julieta, which got basically no release in the U.S. It wasn't even shortlisted for the Academy Award this year, but it's one of it's his best movie since Broken Embraces, by far. It's such a beautiful, it's a beautiful view of grief. And I know that saying that makes you just not want to see it, but it's absolutely hilarious at certain times. It's wonderful. It's heartwarming. It's brilliant. And it's Almodovar purposely stepping away from melodrama, which is something that he's embraced throughout his entire career. So it's interesting to see that.
No clogs in this, right?
No, thank goodness. But it's visually impressive. The pair of women performances at the center is astonishing, and it's definitely worth your time. I'm just so sorry that it didn't get a bigger release when it came out here in January.
Any particular thoughts, speculations as to why it's in the shadows there?
It didn't do well when it was released in Spain because apparently some political thing was going on, and so they couldn't promote it like they wanted to. And I think what sort of sells Almodovar here in America is his melodrama, right?
Sure.
The ones that do the best are the most melodramatic, bad.
Well, like even a little over the toppy type of melodrama, right?
Right. Yeah,
kind of heightening that tone.
And a little bit of sexuality, too. I think that's consistent.
This one does have a lot of sexuality, so there is that. Yeah. But I just think it's too small of a movie. to actually get that much. And if it wasn't Almodovar, it wouldn't get a release at all, which is a shame because it's a masterpiece.
That is a shame, yeah. So I'd like to see it. Hopefully it'll come out. All right, David, what's your piece of flair?
Well, we've talked about Target. We talked about Costco. I got a Costco deal the other day, a couple weeks ago, I think it was. They are selling the That's Entertainment Blu-ray box set for $17. This is a three-disc set. That's Entertainment Part 1, 2, and 3. I've seen Parts 1 and 2 multiple times over the years. This is basically an anthology of big musical set pieces from the MGM archives. And it's a really nice history of the big splashy, you know, musical on screen with all the greats, you know, Astaire and Gene Kelly and Sid Charisse and just, you know, all of that. So if you really just want to get a, you know, that's Entertainment really sums it up. It's amazing. Some of the stuff that they actually pulled off is just quite spectacular. So you get really kind of a greatest hits anthology of movie musicals without having to sit through all the story or the lesser production numbers. Not that there's anything wrong with those movies as a whole, but this just kind of puts the best stuff right up in front of you. It's also kind of fun because you're getting to see some of the stars like, you know, Sinatra and Elizabeth Taylor back in the 70s and the 80s when these films were made, kind of reciting some of their memories of making these great films. So it's an amazing package. Three jam-packed Blu-rays with all kinds of supplements for $17. If it's still there at Costco, definitely worth the price. Grab it and have some fun with it.
I just pulled up the Blu-ray on Amazon, and it's $100, so that's quite a deal.
Yeah, it's an amazing. I mean, I was finding it like for $35 anywhere else. So I don't know where Costco got a big load of them, but definitely worth the pursuit if they're not sold out yet.
Well, my piece of flair, and it's tough to find these when you do a show this regularly, but I'm a big fan of Region B stuff, and Aero Cinema announced their releases, and I already pre-ordered the 3-disc limited edition of Dario Argento's Phenomenon. And I do like Giallo, and I do like limited edition stuff, especially if it's expensive. Because I was able to use my especially if it's expensive. I like it cheap, but especially if it's like a box set kind of thing. So I use my Aero points, so I got it for like a pound plus shipping. So it ended up being about $5 American, which is
amazing.
Pretty good deal, even though I technically paid for it already. So that is the Criterion Now 5. Thanks for joining me, guys. Fun show.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah, we packed a lot in there, but it was definitely great being with you, Aaron, and really nice to connect with you here, Robert. We've had a little bit of chat back and forth. Welcome to the Criterion Cast as a contributing podcaster. Good to have you with us, man.
Welcome to the airwaves.
Hopefully I will stick around. Hashtag save Robert.
All right, guys. Well, great times. Happy Sunday. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.